What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod, Pina of Sports Illustrated. Michael, I gotta say, I had a good time last night reading your article about Michael Porter Jr.'s defense. Now, you were digging deep into like the 30th page of the thesaurus, finding some, you know, old English words to use to kind of like really politely critique Michael Porter Jr. I'm curious. I mean, sometimes in the story generation process, is it just that you're so pained by the Boston Celtics, you know, being 500 that you've got to lash out and just, you know, kind of take out all of your angst upon poor Michael Porter Jr.? I mean, I felt bad for the guy. I didn't disagree with the words you wrote. I really was laughing at a number of the video clips that you pulled in, where you've got Michael Malone pulling his hair out on the sidelines when Porter's jumping at ball fakes and all sorts of stuff. But can you just walk me through your process quickly on that one? Is everything okay? Are you good? Everything is all right?
No, I mean, you know, you want to be as positive as possible through a very trying time right now. And I usually am optimistic when I'm writing about players. And, you know, I tried to look on the bright side with Michael Porter Jr. a tad in that piece to kind of balance it out. But, like, there's only so much footage you can watch before you're like, I got to write about this because no one else is. And it is a true catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, I was just trying to find your all-star picks and came across that column, and I was like, wow, Michael was on one. I don't know. I better check in on his mental well-being. It's a great piece. People should go read it. It's very revelatory. I mean, I think most people, when they're watching Michael Porter Jr., do have that kind of slap-your-head moment every once in a while, but to just see it all laid bare side by side was quite a treat. Anyway, we are not here to pile on. Michael's already done that plenty. What we are here to discuss, Michael, is you released your official All-Star selections, and I was bracing for some really wacky picks, to be honest. Like, I just didn't know if you're I didn't know if you were going to be going too deep into the stat nerd stuff. I didn't know if you were going to be taking your eye off the ball. I am still just completely offended that you don't have James Harden in your starting lineup for the Eastern Conference. I think it's the biggest mistake that you and many other people out there have been making when they're trying to put together these rosters. But look, you know, we're not here to dwell on that. We are here to run through some of the biggest conversations about the reserves. So let me just start this conversation by having you just quickly list the 12-man roster that you put together for the Eastern Conference, and then maybe name, you know, one or two, maybe three of your toughest snubs, just to give us that context. Then we're going to dig into some discussion questions. So hit me with your Eastern Conference roster.
Sure. So in the East, I have Joel Embiid, Giannis, KD, Brad Beal, and Jaylen Brown as my starters. And then reserves, I have Tatum, Chris Middleton, Bam Adebayo, Kyrie Irving, your favorite player, James Harden, Julius Randle, and Zach LaVine. So that's my East team. And then...
and the snubs. So who are the toughest guys that you left off?
Man, there were a lot, actually, I got to say, particularly this year.
Yeah, it was one of those things where, like, look, I mean, there was really only about seven guys who were actually All-Stars, but there was about 25 guys you could make an All-Star case for. At least that was my opinion. So anyway, who are your toughest guys to leave off? Just give me a couple.
Yeah, so like Vucevic in Orlando has just been having an incredible season statistically, but it's Orlando. Trae Young, love Trae Young. He just completely obliterated the Boston Celtics last night with 40 points and like 20 shots. Just an amazing player. And like you know, you want to pick a player from a team that's doing okay. So Domas Sabonis in Indiana probably is a snub as well. But, you know, there's only 12 spots.
Absolutely. So let's start with how important winning was for your criteria this year. You mentioned the idea of rewarding teams that are on good teams. In the Eastern Conference, frankly, not too many good teams this year. And so there would be a temptation maybe to load up with multiple Sixers, to take multiple Bucks like you did, and to kind of approach it that way, to take all three Brooklyn Nets stars. And I think those guys are all no-brainers. As you were putting together your rosters this year, taking into account that it's a shorter schedule, it's a smaller number of games, it is a weird year where, you know, it's very bottom-heavy in the standings. How much were you rewarding winning compared to a normal year? Because for me, when I was making my picks this year, I found myself defaulting to winning a lot simply because a lot of the candidates who might normally be in the pool maybe they didn't play enough games, and maybe that translated to their team's struggles. And I didn't necessarily want to give these gigantic benefit of the doubts, and kind of sacrifice on principles like availability and consistency and reliability, just to make up for the fact that, hey, you know, they missed 2 weeks and that's why their team's bad. It was a tricky thing to kind of balance this year. I tended to err on the side of, look, let's reward the guys who have been able to be out there on the court, not necessarily punishing guys that couldn't, mm-hmm. but at least just rewarding people who have done it night to night and have had that, you know, show through in the standings. Did you take a different approach or the same approach?
I think historically, when I look at stuff like this, I don't factor in winning as much. Like, if you are in a truly hellacious situation and you're putting up great numbers and your team stinks, and it just feels like empty calories, then sure, I can identify that. But for the most part, you know, I'm pretty analytically based in my decision making. And so if you're super efficient and you're getting buckets and you're making plays for your teammates, but your team isn't winning, then I try to ignore the winning, if that makes any sense. And most of the time I look at, you know, the importance of a certain player on their to their team and their value. And, you know, if you were to take this player off this team, how much worse would they be?
Impact. Yeah, I definitely look at impact too. And it's tricky this year because you have lots of guys putting up huge numbers. And so that's the other challenge is how much do you mm-hmm. dig into, okay, well, if a guy's got gigantic numbers on a team that's losing this year, is it his fault or is it the absences around him? It was a tricky year from mm-hmm. a selection standpoint. Before we get any further, Michael, I did an absolutely atrocious job of burying the league. Today, on Thursday, the NBA officially announced that there will be an All-Star game. It's taking place on Sunday, March 7th, like we all expected. They're going to do a skills challenge. They're going to do a three-point contest before the actual game. They're going to do the dunk contest at halftime. And they're going to have the Elam ending from last year's All-Star game where they play towards that targeted score and things get a little bit more excited. The players will be flying in on Saturday. They're going to be living in a mini bubble, basically not leaving that hotel. They're going to be flying back out on Sunday. And, you know, we had talked about some of the schedule modifications that they could potentially have to ease some of these player concerns. It sounds like if you've got multiple All-Stars on your team, most likely you're going to get an extra day or two coming out of that All-Star weekend and that midseason break before you've got to play your first game in the second half of the season. So it is a go, Michael. They're doing it. They're donating $2.5 million to HBCUs. And I do think we've talked through the ethics and the question marks about the actual event itself pretty thoroughly on past episodes. But I did think it was noteworthy that Atlanta's mayor kind of came out and was like, please, nobody else come to this. This is only for TV. We don't want you partying. We don't want the clubs. Just please stay home. I think that just adds one more layer to this conversation, which has been pretty complicated here over the last month or so, hasn't it?
It has. And I mean, I'm scrolling through the press release right now. In real time as we're recording, and it's really interesting to me just how many quotes that were included from outside parties to kind of like validate this whole exercise.
No, they got like Spelman College, Morehouse College, they got the Thurgood yeah. Marshall Scholarship Fund. I mean, look, they understand it's an issue, right? And maybe they're protesting against the protests a little bit too much with these included quotes. Is that what you're saying, Michael?
A little bit, yeah. You don't normally see that in a press release announcing an All-Star game. Let's just put it that way.
That's true. Usually we're quoting mascots, you know. I can't wait to be out there on a hoverboard spinning so Aaron Gordon can jump over me. I mean, that's the usual All-Star game press release. Anyway, let's get back on track here. I do got to – can I really yell at you about this Beal selection, Michael? I understand having him as an All-Star this year. It's a worthy selection. I read your defense of him, and I thought it was excellent in terms of pointing to his impact on the Washington Wizards and how basically he's just single-handedly overcoming all the negative stuff that Russell Westbrook is doing this year. James Harden is the best guard in this conference. He's showed it ever since the trade. He showed it again this past week. I'm sure you've got to be impressed by that big-time three-pointer he hit in that impressive win. He's completely overhauled his game to become more of a pass-first player, yet he's still getting his scoring number. He's playing for one of the few winning teams in the conference. If you switched him with Beal, Washington would be better. If you switched Beal with Harden, the Nets would be worse. Harden's had to carry this Brooklyn team with Kevin Durant out for a lot and Kyrie Irving, you know, kind of in and out of the lineup. And I just think it's an absolute no-brainer, and I think people are holding the ugly stuff against him in terms of the trade mm-hmm. request. Michael, this is the All-Star game, not the National Honor Society. You know what I mean? Like, there's no character. I mean, like, there is probably some line that he could cross, punching an official or something like that, where, okay, we've got to slow things down and say, all right, we've got to, you know, find a way to sort of punish James Harden for his behavior this season. But, I mean, an ugly trade request. He was fined for it. Technically, he paid his price for the stuff that he did off the court, at least in the NBA's eyes. Why are we holding the starting spot against him? It seems ludicrous given his talent advantage over all the other players in that backcourt category in the Eastern Conference. I think it's crazy, Michael.
I mean, his time in Houston is literally a third of his entire season. So to dismiss that just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Well, didn't they win more games there than Bradley Beal's when winning in Washington? I mean, come on.
This is so interesting to me because, like, throughout that entire time, like, you were very critical of the fact that he was basically not trying his hardest.
Well, so, here's the thing. I'm not going to vote for him for the Sportsmanship Award. I think there's a Twyman Stokes Teammate of the Year Award. Here's some breaking news, Michael. I'm leaving James Harden off my ballot for Teammate of the Year. I think in an MVP conversation, you know, this would definitely be held against him because, like you're saying, it's a meaningful portion of the season. But if we're looking at all-star starters, usually I'm saying I only look at the games from the start of the season to whenever voting cuts off, right? I'm not considering last year. I'm not considering anything else. I'm usually, in 99 out of 100 cases, not considering anything off the court. I'm looking at production. I'm looking at talent. I'm looking at impact on winning. I am saying, okay, just, you know, which guys do we want? Who's had the best cases? He's been out there every single night. And it was an ugly start, and I understand the frustration around it. If I was a Houston fan, it would be really hard for me to forgive, you know, how it went down. But I'm just watching these Nets games. This guy's an absolute killer, man, every night.
Dude, like, you're talking to me. You know I love Harden. Like, you know I think that he's incredible.
I mean, that's why I'm dwelling on it, Michael. I want you to change your mind. I want you to get back to that pro-Harden camp because it feels like you're in a negative headspace with him right now.
I am because, you know, like, the offense is – it's insanely good right now. And I do not disagree with you that if you swapped him with Beal or you swapped him with Jaylen that – the Celtics would be better, and that's really saying something because Jaylen's having a terrific season. I think it's marginal that the Wizards would be better, to be honest with you. I don't think any human being alive could save that team. Maybe LeBron could, probably, because he can do anything. But I don't know. Like, Harden is shooting, what, 50, 40, 90 right now in a Nets uniform? Like, he's insane. Like, he's leading the league in assists. He's a brilliant offensive player. He's really not trying at all on the defensive end still in Brooklyn. It hasn't really mattered yet, but that is also a factor here for me. And getting to play, I know the Phoenix game is most, it's like etched in our brains right now because it's most recent and he was terrific in it, but he also gets to play with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and assume this role of playmaker that's basically like, I don't like it's stress free for him, I would imagine. Like, he has so much space to operate in. He's got Joe Harris, who's like the best 3-point shooter in the league right now, also on the floor with him. He's got DeAndre Jordan diving to the basket for lobs. Like, it's just a perfect situation for him. And so I'm not really denying that he's been great. I just can't, like, if the margins are very slim, I'm not going to reward him when Beal's been playing the entire season, just going bananas in Washington in a historically successful way as an individual scorer, like doing MJ early 20s stuff. Like, that is, it's just like, it feels like what Beal is doing is special. And maybe a little bit of it is also the fact that Beal was not an all-star last year. And I know we're not supposed to look at this stuff, but he wasn't an all-star last year and he did not make an all-NBA team despite averaging 30 points a game. Like, that just feels like a little wrong to me. And like, I don't know, man. He's been leading the league in scoring, like, with a massive number, and he hasn't been particularly inefficient doing it, despite, like, Ish Smith being on the floor with him. Like, it's amazing.
But, I mean, most nights these games don't really matter. They're just track meets for the Washington Wizards. Like, I think I'm not calling them empty stats, but they're absolutely inflated by their pace. It's inflated by the fact that, you know, they're out there just saying, hey, go do whatever the heck you want. Teams don't have to load up on Bradley Beal because they can beat the Wizards without any, like, real junk defenses or anything like that. It's just, you know, go out and have a good time, Bradley Beal, because, you know, your team's not necessarily a threat. I'm still willing to respect him enough to put him onto my all-star roster, but this idea that he's been one of the five best players in the Eastern Conference this year, I just don't see it. I really, really, really don't see it. But we're dwelling there. Michael, let's move on to a couple of the other debates that we have going, some of the most interesting ones. If I'm not mistaken, we have all the other starters the same, right? Jaylen Brown, KD, Joel Embiid, Giannis, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
How close was it for you between Jaylen and Kyrie? I think that we're both of the opinion, I don't want to speak for you, but I think we're both of the opinion that if you have players who are well-rounded and two-way impact guys and are out there night to night, that should take precedence over, you know, spectacular one-way players, which is sort of this debate between Jaylen and Kyrie. You know, we might call Kyrie the more talented player, but to me, in this year's selection process, Jaylen would be the more deserving player. Is that how you landed? How close was that? Did you agonize over it, or did you just automatically give it to Jaylen?
I agree with you, first off, that, you know, I value two-way players more than guys who are one-dimensional, and I wrote a column about Kyrie last week, and just how great he has been offensively and just how putrid he's been defensively. And, like, that matters to me a little bit, like, especially when the team you play for has, like, the worst defense in the NBA or one of, and you are contributing to it so heavily. Whereas with Jaylen, I mean, he plays Jaylen's just been a stud, man. Like, he's putting up the same numbers as Kawhi, really, like, as I wrote about in my picks to kind of rationalize it, like, statistically, he's on par with Kawhi Leonard, and, like, that is ridiculous. I don't think anybody in the world expected that. I certainly did not. And, you know, I look at Jaylen, and compared to Kyrie, like, I also factor in the time off that Kyrie had, where he just kind of walked away from basketball for a little bit. I'm sensitive to the reasons why. The fact that he went to a celebration and didn't wear a mask and was eventually fined $50,000 by the NBA, I mean, that stuff also, I'm not, like, necessarily factoring that into my all-star decision, but not playing for as long as he did when physically healthy, while Jaylen was playing and helping a team that could have really floundered had he not been as productive as he's been, that also matters. So
agree. I think that was the kind of the tiebreaker. If it was going to be close, if you were kind of weighing it back and forth, Jaylen's been rock solid. They've really needed him to be rock solid. The argument of what Boston would look like without Jaylen, God, that's a scary sight. I mean, even you would have to admit they'd struggle without Jaylen this year. So I think you're right on the money there. I like that pick. Let's go to the front court reserve. So you had Julius Randle, is that correct?
I had him as a wild card, actually.
Yeah, so, I mean, some of these ones I don't think there was a lot of debate about. I mean, to me, Chris Middleton, Jason Tatum, you know, Kyrie, if you've got Harden on your bench because you started Beal, I mean, those are all pretty obvious, right? So it comes down to the last couple where we're really debating. You know, Julius Randle versus Domantas Sabonis in Indiana was a really interesting one. You could also throw in Vucevic, you know, who you mentioned in Orlando. How did you land on Randle over Sabonis and Vucevic? I think I'm more personally inclined to go Sabonis. I really liked his All-Star candidacy last year. His numbers this year are better. I mean, 21, 12, 6, plus a steal. You know, efficiency-wise, he's rock solid, kind of like always. He's played a bunch of minutes. You know, he's averaging 36 minutes a night this year, been out there almost every game for Indiana. And I feel like he lost some momentum in these conversations because they trade away Oladipo and they don't get Caris LeVert, so their record comes back to earth, and now all of a sudden everybody forgets about the Pacers. And so to me, I wanted to reward the Pacers' overall team success, and I felt like he was their most deserving candidate, although Brogdon had a case as well. Why are you snubbing Sabonis in favor of Julius Randle, Michael?
I mean, this was really tough. I'm not going to lie.
It was. You could argue for both of them, honestly, and take somebody else off. They're both deserving candidates. But what was Randall's kind of best argument?
I guess it was just like, man, like statistically, they were so dead even in scoring, in assists, in, you know, PER. Their PER is like literally identical right now at 20.7. Their usage rates are similar. Their assist rates, their rebound rates. With Randall, it's like he suddenly is just helping the Knicks, helping his team, the Knicks, in a way that he just never has before, where he is like solid defensively. He's hitting threes. He's playmaking in a way that, like, you know, he'll grab and go, but he's not out of control anymore. Like, he'll just create mismatches, read the defense, either bully ball or like bully ball and then dump off when he has help, or kick out to the 3-point line. And the one stat that, and this probably isn't even fair to Sabonis maybe, but like the on-off splits for him sealed the deal for me, where when he's on the court, they get outscored by their opponent. And when he's off, the Indiana Pacers are like running over opponents. So take that for, which, I mean, this is just a weird season. I'm not saying that like Sabonis is bad for his team at all, of course, but yeah, when you're splitting hairs, that's what it comes down to.
For sure. And I don't know exactly how to explain that, because when he's on the court with Turner, they're really good, if I'm not mistaken, right? And then there's these extra minutes where basically he's playing and Turner's not. And I think in those situations, that's when they're losing. So I guess maybe mm-hmm. they've got him in situations where he's like the one guy out there as like the, you know, carrying bench lineups, I would imagine, is kind of what comes down with those minutes. And maybe that's where they're sacrificing that time. Or maybe it's just a more dramatic swing after they've been losing these games compared to earlier in the year where they were racking up a lot of wins and winning by a pretty nice margin. It's tricky. I just think if I was picking one player, who would I rather have right now? I mean, I think Sabonis causes more problems than Randall does, even though Randall's been awesome this season. So that was one of my tie-breaking factors. Obviously, Indiana has a slightly better record, but Sabonis also has more help. So I think there's a case to be made for Randall of like, look, he's doing more with less, right? He's got almost a comparable record in the standings. And you look at his supporting cast versus, you know, a lot of the vets that Sabonis has been playing with and guys who have shared minutes together. So it's a little bit easier to come out of the gate strong. And that just wasn't the case in New York. I mean, they got a lot of young players, new faces, new coach and everything else. So Randall deserves a lot of attention. I mean, to me, I think Randall might have been my toughest cut. I haven't absolutely finalized my rosters. I'm going to wait to do that until I write for the Sunday paper. But he's looking like the toughest cut. And, you know, I think that Knicks fans are right to be stating this case. Randall's right to be putting a story in the New York Times about how he should be an all-star. I mean, like, they should be ramping this one up because it's been a while since they've had somebody even in that conversation. Let's shift gears here to some of the other kind of like last guys in or last guys out. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You have Zach LaVine on your roster?
I do, yes.
What were you thinking, Michael? Come on, Michael.
Wow. Look, I was surprised because, like, Zach LaVine, I think you and I are aligned here, just not our type of basketball player. You know, when we talk about empty calories, when we talk about winning impact, we've literally never seen it with this guy. Like, he can get buckets, shoot threes, pull up threes.
Just put whipped cream on the popcorn, Michael. I mean, that's all we're doing here. This is the emptiest possible. No, I'm kidding. Look, Zach LaVine's had a nice season offensively. There is no denying that. He's an exciting player. He is much better than he was last year. He was better than he was the year before. I mean, he's progressing along at what he does well. The team's losing. He's one of the worst defensive players in the NBA at his spot. And I have a hard time overlooking both of those combined factors. He's a better playmaker for his teammates than he was in the past, but that's saying absolutely nothing because he had some of the biggest blinders ever in the history of the NBA until about 2 years ago. I'm not going to fall in love with that points per game number, Michael. Are you really taking Zach LaVine over Ben Simmons in a situation where you need to win basketball games? Come on, Michael. You're not doing that. Like, in games that matter, when push comes to shove, you're taking Ben Simmons over Zach LaVine. You just are.
Here's the thing, though. Like, why is that a parameter for picking an all-star team? Like, I'm picking the guy who's had the most impressive season up until this point. Like, that's the whole exercise, right?
So, right. But, well, the reason why is because all these games are designed to be won, and Philly has won some, and Chicago has won fewer. And Ben Simmons has contributed to more wins in those situations. It's not just an accident. If you switched them, Philly would be worse. And Chicago probably would be a little bit better. I mean, I'm not sure there would be a major impact there. It would be very impressive to see. I think Simmons' fans would say, well, look how he played the other night without Embiid. He scored 40 points. He could do that more regularly if he had his own team. And certainly Chicago could use the playmaking that he brings to the table. But, you know, when we're looking at all-around players and trying to reward team success, I get that Simmons is not that guy every single night. I mean, sometimes his efforts do drive me crazy. I think he's made a little bit of a push here later in the season. And I just think Philadelphia deserves to have two All-Stars. I think it's pretty clear Simmons over Harris. I know Harris was trying to make his own campaign. I just don't really see that one. I think some of his scoring numbers also gets into the emptier territory where it's a more replaceable contribution. But defensively, you know, Simmons's reputation on that end is well earned. I mean, certainly he's close to being as good as Zach is offensively on the defensive end, and he's miles better offensively than Zach is on the defensive end. So any way you break it down, I think you got to have Simmons over LaVine, Michael.
I actually didn't even like consider Simmons for the All-Star. Like, I've had him as a snub in my column, but I didn't seriously think about him as, I mean, you like take the whole season into account. Like, Simmons has had so many duds, and whenever he shows out, as he did against the Jazz in a game, by the way, where he's being defended by Rudy Gobert and Derek Favors for a majority of the time because, like, he can't shoot, which impacts everything around him at all times. Like, there were those games. There was the game against the Celtics where he had a great fourth quarter, and it spawned, like, all these different columns across media that Simmons is unstoppable. And it's like, how many other players where it's just like this guy has one good fourth quarter and it's like we need to say that he is Magic Johnson, that he is the second coming.
Well, you know how I feel about Magic Johnson comparisons.
I know.
No to LaMelo Ball and hard no to Ben Simmons too.
So what I'll just say is with Zach LaVine, you know, I am in the camp that it's questionable how much he does impact winning, but when you're scoring as much as he is, as efficiently as he is, like in a way that, you know, he's getting to the rim, shooting 70% at the rim, he's shooting over 50% from the mid-range, he's shooting over 40% from the three-point line. All these shots are really tough for him. Also, the degree of difficulty is astronomical. His usage is above 30. His true shooting is above 65, which is something that has only been done twice in NBA history. Once by Steph Curry in 2016, which is like the greatest offensive season any of us have ever seen. And then it's also what Embiid, who is the leading candidate for MVP, I would say, is doing right now. It's never been done beyond that. So, like, I look at that and I'm just like, there's a threshold here where I can't ignore what this guy is doing and how effectively he's doing it.
I look at that and I say, look, this is a weird year where no one's playing defense. There's no fans in the stands and we're going to have some strange statistical anomalies. I mean, I look at Chicago's offense below average right now, right there in the middle of the pack. If he is this all-time great offensive playmaking scoring threat, his team should be able to be a little bit above average. It should translate a little bit more than it has. And I understand he's averaging 28 and Simmons is probably averaging 15. And so there's a pretty big gap there. I promise you, Zach LaVine's given all those points back on the other end every single night. And Simmons is making up for it with his passing. So I don't want to fixate too much on this particular debate. But I do think the Zach LaVine love fest has just gone about 25% too far on the internet. Like, he's solid, but, and he's definitely better than he was last year. He's been getting on that track where he gets to say that he's proving his critics wrong. At the same time, his critics are pretty right about a lot of what Zach LaVine's doing on the basketball court. And if they weren't, Chicago would be in prime position to be a really nice playoff seed this year because the Eastern Conference is wide open, and it just hasn't played out that way.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at Ben Simmons' game logs, it's like if Zach LaVine scored like 10 or 11 points six games in a row, like, you think the Chicago Bulls are bad now, like, they would be relegated to the NCAA. So, yeah, I don't know.
The Bulls need everything that LaVine's giving them on offense, but they also need a lot more than he's giving them on the other end. All right, let me ask you on this, because it's also another kind of corollary factor. How much did you consider Jeremy Grant? Because I think there's Pistons fans who would say, well, look at Jeremy Grant's numbers. They're not that different from LaVine's, you know, from a scoring standpoint. And head-to-head, Jeremy Grant's got probably better scoring number than Ben Simmons. So, you know, you've got another case where should you have a second player from a winning team on Philly versus, you know, a single selection from a losing team in Detroit. How seriously did you consider Jeremy Grant? Because I know he's got his own, you know, group of stands just like LaVine does.
I didn't really consider him.
Excellent. Great. Either. I'm glad.
I mean, the numbers are great. Or I should say they're very good. But it's like with LaVine, it's just like, again, there was a threshold for me. I don't know what exactly it was. But like, if he were averaging 25 instead of 28, or shooting 43% from the floor instead of 52, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, the numbers are good, for sure. You're playing on the worst team in the NBA, probably, and
it's amazing.
Like, have to get...
Like, it's not easy to be worse than the Wizards. They didn't even play for 2 weeks, or practice for 2 weeks, and Detroit's still worse than them. I mean, that's not easy. That's a heavy lift. And by the way, Cleveland's now down there as well, which is just phenomenal. That was a rock hard fall in the standings for the Cavaliers. They went west, and I think they just went 0-for on the trip or something like that. And next thing you know, life came at them fast. But I hear what you're saying. LaVine is a more deserving candidate than Grant because he's more efficient, he's scoring more overall, and he's playing for a better team. Is that basically what it boiled down to?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, that solved that. you took Bam, am I right?
I did, yes. Love Bam.
Did you think about Jimmy Butler at all as a Miami candidate? Now, granted, he's basically missed half the season because of health and protocol and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. He has a major impact on winning. Some people would look back and say, well, look, I mean, Jimmy's obviously their most important player. Just look at what happened in the NBA Finals. And they might want to just kind of slide him in there on reputation. Were you tempted to consider Jimmy over Bam? Were you tempted to consider both those guys? I personally had Bam because he's basically averaging 20-10, and he's, you know, right at the top of the list of bigs who would you pick from the Eastern Conference. You know, basically right after Embiid, he's probably the next pick, and in certain matchups, you might even prefer to have Bam over Embiid. So I was with you on Bam, but did you give any other consideration to Jimmy?
I didn't, to be honest. He just hasn't played enough, as you said. Like, Bam has played 10 more games. The Miami Heat are, I mean, they're a disappointment as a team for a lot of understandable reasons. But regardless, their record is what their record is, and where they are in the standings is not great. So for Bam, who's, you know, played a lot more minutes than he's not, then, you know, if you look at the on-offs, you know, 800-plus minutes on, 400-plus minutes off, as opposed to 500-plus for Jimmy on and 800-plus off, like, you know, that really matters. And I know that the Heat are very good when Jimmy plays, understandably so, because he's terrific and his playmaking is really good. He's also 4-for-24 from behind the three-point line, and I'm not, like, expecting Klay Thompson production, but that's not good shooting right there. So when I looked at Bam, you know, you outlined some of the basic numbers which matter. He's just, like, one of the best defenders in basketball, too. One of the true 1-through-5s. Who can really guard anyone. And, you know, I value that as well. And his playmaking, his rebounding, the fact that he's suddenly added a mid-range shot that's reliable to his skill set is impressive to me. He's going to be in an all-star game for, like, the next 10 years. And I didn't think that anything he did this year really negated that.
Well, let me ask you, do you think the coaches will select him? Will they honor him in the same way that you want to honor him? Is he going to be one of those, like, you know how the coaches have, like, their fetish picks every year where it's like, guys, we're always bringing in, right? For a while, it was Joe Johnson. They always made sure they got him on there. Do you think he's got that level of respect I'm not sure he's necessarily going to make it this year. I expect him to, but I don't know if I'm going to write him in 100% just because of Miami's record. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that that's fair. I think that maybe coaches who really value winning look at the Sixers and they say, oh, look at Tobias Harris's shooting. Like, let's throw him in there instead.
Oh, yeah. Doc's going to start buying Rolexes for all the fellow coaches, try to make his campaign for his guys. I could see that happening. I hope it doesn't. I hope Bam's in there over Tobias. I'll say that. Let's wrap up this Eastern Conference portion of it with just one final question, Michael. Why are you such a Trae Young hater? Don't you like fun? Weren't the Atlanta Hawks your squad coming into this season? What's going on? What's going on, Michael? How do you not have Trae Young on your roster whatsoever? I mean, you're right, but why are you so mean and angry?
I adore Trae Young, as you know. I think he's one of the best passers alive. Just living at the free throw line despite being a tiny human being and not missing like any games at all, really. Like he's ridiculous. Love him. It was, for me, it was between Trey and LaVine, to be honest with you, and that was the real flip of the coin. And
yeah, if those are my options, I'm just out, you know. It's like
I mean, Atlanta has had a ton of injuries this year, and we don't know what they would look like if everyone was healthy, but I think they're like a respectable basketball team, and you know, their defense is not that atrocious, so we haven't seen some of Trey's blemishes really come to the forefront that much, which is nice to see for him. But like, just efficiency again, like that's really the word of the day for me when it comes to the LaVine versus Simmons versus Trae Young debate.
No, I think you're right on. When it, you know, Chicago and Atlanta have very similar records, I would actually argue Trae came into the season probably with more help than LaVine did. LaVine's efficiency, his scoring number, I think that actually makes him a stronger candidate than Trae this year. I mean, Trey, you know, I'm not saying that he got exposed this year, but it's been a rough season. He's trying to find his way working with talented pieces, and I do kind of hold that against him a little bit. And then defensively, they're both messes, so that kind of cancels out to me. I would have Zach LaVine slightly above Trae Young on the pecking order, but I would snub both. And I would like it. I would enjoy that. On the Western Conference, I think it was a little bit easier. Would you agree that it was a little bit easier this year than usual? In part because you had a guy like Karl Anthony Towns just not in the mix, you know, and maybe that cleared up a spot. You know, a few other guys, CJ McCollum would have had a really strong case if not for injury. I just thought usually the Western Conference is just impossible to get to 12. This year, I felt like it was hard, but it wasn't quite as difficult. Did you feel the same or no?
No, this was torture, honestly.
Well, tell me more.
Do you want me to read down my team first and then we'll get into it?
My needs are unconventional, Michael. I want to hear about all your pain selecting your all-stars. Yeah, read your Western Conference 12 for me and then give me your toughest snubs.
Okay, so I had LeBron, Kawhi, Jokic, Dame Lillard, and Steph as my starting five.
You got all five of the starters right. Congratulations. It was a tricky one between Dame and Luka, but you got it correct. And I think people are rallying to that here, especially over the last week as Portland continues to ascend in the standings and Lillard continues to just hit every big shot there is. So continue.
Yeah, he's ridiculous. Next up, I have Anthony Davis. I wrote this the day that we learned about his injury, even though I think he would still make the team for me. Rudy Gobert. Paul George. Next up, we have Luka Doncic, Donovan Mitchell. And then for my wild cards, I had RIP my mentions, De'Aaron Fox and Zion Williamson.
So we are pretty darn close. Give me your snubs.
Okay, so the snubs were tough. And Phoenix Suns fans were not happy with me at all for leaving Chris Paul and more notably Devin Booker off of my team. But
well, I mean, to be honest, you're dead wrong. I mean, you got to have at least one Phoenix Sun person. So they should be mad. You should feel bad. And I hope that they left a mark. But otherwise, you're pretty darn close. Who are your other toughest snubs besides the two Suns guards?
Yeah. Honestly, I took a long look at DeMar DeRozan and the Spurs being a pretty good basketball team this year and him having a very underrated, productive season. I think he deserves a shout-out for sure. And
I'm snubbing him from my snubs list. He's not even going to be on my snubs list.
Sorry. Oh, my goodness gracious.
They just win by collective. You know what I mean? It's not the DeMar show down there. They've got a lot of guys contributing really positive minutes. I feel like defensively, it's still the same old story. Impact, still the same old story. And then offense, you know, some nights he's there, some nights he's not. And they can still win games when he's not. I just think it's a different mix. And so that's where I came down on that one.
That's honestly how I feel about the Suns, but we can debate that in a second. And then I think like the biggest, most painful cut for me was Mike Conley, who like the Jazz are just obliterating the rest of the NBA. What are they, like 22-5? He's missed the past few games, but like his all the advanced stats love him, and he's playing so much better than he did last season. And it's just like this guy, you know, you want to try your best to avoid everything like, you know, historical context and some of this stuff and narrative and all that. But Mike Conley not ever making an All-Star game and playing this well in what would potentially be his last chance. You just want to see him make it, man. And it stinks that maybe he will. I'm like reading some other writers' teams, and they have Mike Conley on there. I couldn't make the case, honestly,
We'll come back to that one because I do think one of the key questions here is how many Jazz people get rewarded given how ridiculous their season is. And their coaching staff's going to be the Western Conference coaching staff, so that's quite the honor for Quinn Snyder, who to me has got to be the runaway favorite right now for Coach of the Year. Before we get to that, though, I think we do face this AD dilemma. So he's obviously deserving if he's healthy. He might be sitting the next couple of weeks, so his games played number is going to look pretty strange by the time they actually play the All-Star game. And yet usually we do this selection process based on, you know, the start of the season two, whenever you have to actually make your picks, which is coming up here. So he's only going to be missing a couple of games, you know, before the end of that cutoff. I think the best, fairest, most equitable solution here is to select Anthony Davis, assuming that he's going to be injured, you know, until the rest of the first half of the regular season. Give him his All-Star nod for the history books, you know, for his personal resume, and then just also use that as a cheat code to bring in an extra injury reserve. You know what I mean? So you can get one other guy taken care of. And so to me, that's the cleanest solution. So if you select AD, then you get to have a 13th All-Star, and then it gets a lot easier. What do you think, Michael? Should we just be?
I agree. Okay. Yes. All right. That's a great idea.
So we're doing that. Maybe maybe you won't anger the Suns fans if you can kind of handle this thing properly. I'm giving you a second chance, all right? So to me, Luka, no-brainer. Anthony Davis is in. Paul George is in. Rudy Gobert is in. Let's talk about the Jazz.
Okay.
Gobert is in for sure. We could both agree. I think they've got to have two spots no matter what, personally. I just, you know, if you have this high performing of a team, this consistent of a team during a year where nobody else is consistent, we have to reward that winning. And it comes down to Mitchell versus Conley. You picked Mitchell. What is the argument for Mitchell over Conley? And why didn't you try to get both of them in there? Why didn't you prioritize getting three Jazz players?
I tried so hard, Ben. I lost a little bit of sleep over it. I looked at Jordan Clarkson's numbers. It was a dark time for me.
We need some defense in that game. What about Royce O'Neal? You know, nobody really commits on the defensive end. Could we fit Royce O'Neal into the 2021 All-Star Challenge?
Let's give Derek Favors a spot while we're here. Like, just a true king. Why did I pick Donovan Mitchell?
Derek Favors could be an assistant coach for the Western Conference. We could do that. Just bring him along. He could be on Quinn's staff.
The best. I picked Donovan Mitchell because, in my opinion, I think he's their best player. I really do. I think that Rudy Gobert might be their most important player, and strategically and schematically.
I think Rudy's their best player, man. Yeah, but you could say Donovan's the most talented. I'll go there. But Rudy is having a major, major impact this year.
Oh, yeah, no question. He has a major impact every year. How Utah's defense, Utah's defense is good every year because Rudy Gobert plays for their team. They paid him a ton of money for a reason. I don't like, I don't discount anything that he does that doesn't even show up statistically. Like, I understand why his screens are important. I get the putbacks. I understand his ability to drop in pick and roll and let everybody stay at home on the three-point line, and that is foundational to their success. Like, I get all of that for sure. For me, like, Donovan is the player who, if Rudy ups your floor, Donovan raises your ceiling. And sometimes, especially when I look at the Utah Jazz, I need someone to raise their ceiling if they want to win the championship. Does that make sense to you?
It does, and I would agree. I also think, though, that like they could get by and win an awful lot of games without Donovan this year. I just feel like Rudy's the more irreplaceable piece, so that's why I would have him kind of as the no-brainer selection. I mean, they've actually shown the ability to win games without Donovan and without Mike Conley, so that argument's almost mute. It's really, really hard between those two guys. Let's say they had to go for a month without Mitchell or without Conley. Which way do you think they survive, better? Like, how are they winning more games? Because that one, to me, is also really, really close. As you mentioned, the advanced stats absolutely love Mike Conley's impact. I think his shared minutes with Rudy Gobert have been, big-time positive driver of their success. He's handling the ball and shooting the ball quite well. And yet they have still won without him, during this current stretch. And same thing, and Mitchell hasn't missed as much time, I don't believe, but they've won with him out as well. Who do you think is harder to replace? And that might be a tiebreaker here. Is Mitchell harder to replace?
I think Mitchell is harder to replace because Conley has missed their last six games. And let me just read you the outcomes of those games. The first one was at Indiana. They won by 8. Next, their home against Boston, they win by 14. Next, home against Milwaukee, they win by 14. Next, home against Miami, they win by 18. Next, home against Philly, they win by 11. Next, they're in Staples Center against the Clippers, they win by 18.
Well, all that told me is that the Eastern Conference is terrible, which I already knew. And the Clippers game, they did beat them without Paul George and Kawhi Leonard.
Sure.
But, that is, frankly, that's really damning for the top of the Eastern Conference. They just smoked all those teams, and that's like the top five seeds in the East, basically.
And that Clippers team without PG and Kawhi has been, like, nothing to mess around with either. Like, Lou Williams and Luke Kennard and all those guys, Serge Ibaka, like, they beat the Miami Heat the other day. So that's no pushover, and they blew them out of the water, too. So I think Utah, if Mike Conley hadn't missed those games, I still think Utah would have won all of them, probably
by 25 points.
Yeah, with more ease than they did, for sure. The fact that he did miss it is kind of what the combination of the fact that he did miss it and there are just so many other candidates, I think, is what, like, really strong candidates in my eyes really hurt the case for Conley. If he was healthy, I'd be much more comfortable putting him in here.
No, it's a great point. Very well argued. I think you probably convinced me. I want to dig a little bit deeper on that one before I make my final call, but I think Conley's injury is probably going to wind up being the tiebreaker and holding him out yet again. I don't really get into the sentimental stuff as much as some people do about, oh, we got to get him one spot. I mean, I would do it if it felt like it was deserved. But this year, I can see the case for the snub. So we've only got a few more minutes here, Michael, so let's run through these quickly. You have to have Chris Paul on your team, man. I don't get it. Chris Paul has to be an all-star. I understand the case for Fox is pretty strong. I understand why people would be really upset about Booker. But I think if you're going to take one son, and they need to have a representative based on the winning, to me it's Chris Paul. All-around impact, closing games. He's massive for them in late-game situations. I don't think it's some sort of a coincidence that all of a sudden the Phoenix Suns are winning games and in the playoff mix for the first time in years and years and years in the first year that Chris Paul happens to get there. His scoring number isn't as big as Booker, but if I'm picking between those two players to win games, there's no question in my mind I'm taking Chris Paul over Devin Booker. And, the Fox case is very interesting. Their record's quite a bit, back in the standings compared to Phoenix. And so I just couldn't get over that mental hump. I don't think De'Aaron Fox has been so good and that it should outweigh the steady team success that Phoenix has had. So you got to make the case how you snub both of these Phoenix Suns, or will you bring one of those guys onto your roster with the Anthony Davis injury exception? And that could maybe be a compromise that would get me to stop yelling at you.
I'm not certain that I'm going to choose. If I had to choose one, I think it would be man, this is so tough. I think I would choose Booker.
Ugh.
But at the same time,
Michael,
Ben,
you just like these Booker types, these LaVine types. Maybe you should have Trey have Trey and Bradley Beal in your starting lineup together. Why not? Why not just do that, Michael?
I picked Devin Booker last year to make the All-Star team when his team was 22-33 at the All-Star break. So like winning, like this is the Phoenix Suns fans in my mentions. Like I like the winning isn't that much of a factor to me. It does play a small role, but like I look at Fox and like comparing him strictly with Booker, because like I think Paul is just a different, like I think he impacts winning obviously and he's tremendous, but I
never forget, like, that's what we're here for, Michael, to win in life, in basketball, on the court, off the court. Chris Paul put this whole All-Star weekend together. He can't get an invite to his own party, Michael?
I know. Yeah, I know. That's all that matters, and that's why we look at the first 8 games of James Harden's season, and we're like, hey, come down to Atlanta, James. Be in the starting lineup. I think that for Fox, like, you talked about crunch time. Like, he's been one of the better crunch time players in the entire league this season. He's surrounded by much less help and a roster that makes much less sense than the one in Phoenix. And by the way, Devin Booker has been atrocious in the clutch this year, which is weird because, yeah, he has Chris Paul. He has spacers like Cam Johnson, like Mikal Bridges, like dive guy like Ayton. Meanwhile, like there are lineups for sure that Fox is in that are conducive to success with Harrison Barnes at the four, but he's starting a lot of games with Marvin Bagley and Rashawn Holmes in the front court. Like, that's tough stuff. And so you just look at this guy's game, man. Like, the numbers are about on par with Booker. But like I said, he's better in the in crunch time. He's a better playmaker with a much higher assist rate. And I just generally think he's doing more with less. Like, who is Sacramento's second best player?
No, like that, like, there's no argument there. Like, the Kings, he's dragging a rough Kings team. I just don't think he's dragging them high enough. Let me put it to you this way. If you switch Chris Paul and De'Aaron Fox, do the Kings have a better record? I would say yes.
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I don't know if I would agree. I don't think that Chris Paul.
Here's my my argument. Okay. The best Houston Rockets team ever, Chris Paul showed up and he was a big part of it. Oklahoma City was the biggest overachiever last year. Chris Paul was the driver of it, right? Phoenix this year, they're basically maxing out their best case scenario from preseason expectations by getting into that 4 or 5 seed range. I had them closer, you know, to an 8 seed probably this year. That overachievement, to me, again, it goes back to Chris Paul. Devin Booker's not winning those games in the clutch like you're describing. It's not like he's a bum. He's had some really, really good games, especially recently offensively, big scoring games. But the difference in the key moments, it's Chris Paul in obvious ways orchestrating, making sure his teammates know where to be, but and then also just more subtle ways, expertise, communication with his teammates, on-court leadership, all that stuff really matters, and I think it should be reflected in All-Star voting. I think if you put him on Sacramento, they're better, maybe not that much better than they are currently because Fox has been doing an awesome Superman job of putting everybody on his back, but I do think the Sacramento Kings would be better if they switched those two players.
I just don't think that Chris Paul is at a place in his career where he can carry a load like that. Like, what De'Aaron Fox does in the fourth quarters of some of these games is heroic, and like Chris Paul, yes, he raises the floor for you, he makes everyone around him better. I like, he's not the guy who can, you know, just go off for 10 points in the fourth quarter with his team entering the period down 8. You know what I mean?
No,
like, that's just
he
not who he is at this stage of his career.
He doesn't need the sledgehammer, though. He just has that scalpel. You know, it's not going to be like a 14-point explosion. It's going to be, okay, I'm going to find this corner 3-point shooter. Then I'm going to break you down and get to my mid-range jumper from the elbow. Then I'm going to, you know, come up with a steal in the backcourt that you're not expecting. And then I'm going to, you know, he just has so many different ways he could beat guys. One of my, this isn't like a complicated stat. You know, Chris Paul's only missed one game this season, right? And he's playing 30 plus minutes a night. Certainly he has slowed down, right? And so when you're comparing physically a Fox to a Chris Paul, there's like no contest. I mean, Fox could hold up to a lot of minutes, right? Like if Luke Walton was like desperately coaching for his job, he could keep Fox on the court for an awful long time, you know, Thibodeau style. And Fox would be able to handle it no problem in a way that Chris Paul couldn't. But I think if you're saying like quality of minutes, you know, can you get a starter's amount of minutes every single night from a guy? Chris Paul's avoided the injuries so far this season. He did kind of ease into the season a little bit from a minute standpoint, but he's held up brilliantly, and I got to reward that winning. So that's where I come down on that one. The Booker versus Fox flip is pretty interesting too. Like, I bet, would you agree that if you flipped the two of them, the Kings would be worse if they flopped Booker and Fox?
Yes, I do. Actually, I don't. Well, it's like,
because then who passes the basketball? Who's playmaking? Right?
Exactly. You have Halliburton as your starting point guard. Like, I don't know if that works as well. You know, I think Booker's playmaking, you know, his assist rate before Paul came on board was very high. He can make plays for others. I think defensively, there's a little bit of a difference between Fox and Booker. I think that's fair to say, and could be the difference here. But it's just, it's really, I want to stress, it is so close between Booker and Fox. And I just think that Fox has done more with less, and I reward that. I'm sorry. Like, I don't care that much about winning at the end of the day to say that just because Booker's on a better team, he goes to the All-Star game.
Well, 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 I don't care that much about winning at the end of the day, Michael. We're going to have to save that one for the archives. God. So here, just to wrap up quickly. I think you had Zion, correct?
I did, yes. Love Zion.
I think the most poetic way to do it is to have Zion as the injury replacement for Anthony Davis, just like he had to step mm-hmm. in as the replacement for Anthony Davis to save the New Orleans Pelicans franchise. Can we just have that all line up so the coaches don't pick Zion, but we can have Adam Silver name him, you know, in the blatant small market homage, but also like mm-hmm. television rating savior for the All-Star game move? What do you think?
Oh, you know he's going to be in the All-Star game one way or the other.
One way or the other?
That's, yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great idea.
Sort of like the Jeremy Lin move from David Stern, just classic. Yeah, we've created a new spot for Jeremy Lin in the, what was it, skills challenge or something like that. did you give any consideration to Brandon Ingram over Zion when you're picking kind of a Pelicans representative, quote unquote? I mean, to me... Mm-hmm. The Pelicans have been so different night to night. Their ceiling's so high. Their floor can be really low. When they're looking awesome, I just felt like Zion was the one who was driving it because he was winning his individual matchups and putting up these crazy efficient scoring performances and just basically shoving the basketball down his opponent's throats. And that's when they've looked at their best. I feel like Ingram, to a certain degree, has kind of been floating. He's been kind of a stabilizing piece. You pretty much know what you're getting night to night, but I don't necessarily know if I associate his incredible performances with his team's best nights. And so that was one you know, point in favor of Zion over Ingram to me. I do feel like Ingram could be an all-star level guy in a different context. I'm not sure that this roster and this dynamic is set up perfectly for him to shine. I also didn't think he was an all-star last year or you know, he was really borderline to me and just kind of got there because of injury issues. And I don't think that they've won nearly enough to consider having two representatives. So yeah. I did come back to Zion as the Pelicans representative. But I actually didn't have him on my normal reserve roster. I had him as my injury replacement. Does that all check out with where you're at on Zion and Ingram?
Yeah, I think I agree with a lot of that. They were pretty close for me when I started out with this exercise, and I did have Ingram as an all-star last year. I think we've talked about Ingram a lot. I love him. I love his game. I think, you know, we're splitting hairs once again, but if I were a coach who had to strategize against the New Orleans Pelicans, I would be a little bit more concerned about Zion Williamson becoming a point guard all of a sudden.
Yeah,
and
well,
you'd be calling my defense.
Yeah, you'd be calling the local football coach and saying, hey, I need two defensive linemen, please, because we need to plant them in front of the basketball hoop. That's probably going to be your first move if you're a coach of an opposing team.
Exactly. So, like, strategically, he just does so much more that concerns you if you are on the other side of things. And, you know, I'm watching the Blazers game last night, and he's, you know, they have to go to zone when he brings the ball up the floor because he's just getting to the rim at will. And even after they win zone, he still found a way. Like, he's just, he's incredible.
Yeah, and get back on the hype train. Slightly slow start to the season. He's been awesome the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it's tough because there was some real gaps to his game in that first month where you're saying like, look, this guy's probably not an all-star this year. We got to be more patient. But I think he has ramped it up, stepped it up. The efficiency is out of control. I think he deserves to be there. The toughest ones for me here, Michael, Mitchell versus Conley. I'm still kind of weighing that, but I think you might have talked me into Mitchell on that one. You know, for me, I did have Chris Paul, and that left the toughest debate for me was Booker versus Fox. I'm still weighing that one because I do really respect what Fox is doing. I think if you switched Fox and Booker, it would be, you know, it would be tough. I mean, I think that Phoenix would probably be winning just as much, and I think Sacramento might win a little bit less like we described just because of the nature of Fox's playmaking game. So I'm still chewing on those. With your injury replacement slot, Michael, this is your chance. Let's make your final pick here to close this episode out. Who are you going to give it to? I know you had a bunch of snubs. A few other guys we should mention as honorable mentions. I would say Ja Morant, the injury took him out of it. Christian Wood had a chance there for a little bit. I think the injury took him out of it. Jamal Murray just didn't get it together this year to kind of get into the mix. And so I think that was kind of the next cut of players for me. But I didn't actually feel that bad about leaving any of those guys out, frankly. So who are you going to use your injury replacement slot on, Michael? Right now, who's it going to be?
Man, Suns Twitter is not going to be happy.
Oh my gosh! Oh my god! Are you going to give it to Conley?
I
love it.
It's so sentimental for me. Chris Paul has been to a ton of All-Star games. Devin Booker will go to a ton of All-Star games. Already went to one last year. Just like, come on. Like, Mike Conley's been superb this season, and he's one of the big reasons why I think that they can win the championship, because he looks like the guy that they traded for. So, it would just be nice, and I need nice things in my life right now.
Yeah, you're going to get some real nice replies in your mentions. I can't wait to see that. Yeah. You're going to call up Devin Booker and say, hey, we still have some slots available in the three-point contest and the skills challenge if you're interested. Unbelievable, Michael. I cannot believe that you overlooked all of the Suns. That's wild. Well, fascinating picks. Like I said, I expected some even zanier stuff from you, and I thought you did quite well. We only had a few debates and differences, and it was fun to talk those through with you. Everybody should go check out Michael's selections. They're on SI.com right now, and be sure to read that piece on Michael Porter Jr. No joke. I quite enjoyed that as well. All right, Michael, we'll double back next week, I'm sure, with some more All-Star related conversations, and we'll pick up with the rest of the regular season. Until then, guys, you can email us openfloormail@gmail.com. openfloormail@gmail.com. We would love to hear your selections for the All-Star rosters, your biggest debates with our picks, and anybody else that we might have forgot to mention that you feel we slighted. Michael's on Instagram at Michael Villas and Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver. Michael's on Twitter at Michael Villas and Victor Pina, and I'm on Twitter at Ben Golliver. All right, Michael, until next week.
Talk soon, Ben.